Chapter 1. A First View of Jerusalem and of the Temple. And when he was come near, he beheld the city, and wept over it. Luke 19:41. The Charm of Jerusalem. In every age, the memory of Jerusalem has stirred the deepest feelings. Jews, Christians, and Mohammedans turn to it with reverent affection. It almost seems as if, in some sense, each could call it his happy home, the name ever dear to him. For our holiest thoughts of the past and our happiest hopes for the future connect themselves with the city of our God. We know from many passages of the Old Testament, but especially from the book of Psalms, with what ardent longing the exiles from Palestine looked towards it, and during the long centuries of dispersion and cruel persecution, up to this day, the same aspirations have breathed in almost every service of the synagogue, and in none more earnestly than in that of the Paschal night, which to us is forever associated with the death of our Savior. It is this one grand presence there of the desire of all nations, which has forever cast a hallowed light round Jerusalem and the temple, and given fulfillment to the prophecy, "Many people shall go and say, Come, ye, and let us go up to the mountain of Jehovah, to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of Jehovah from Jerusalem." Isaiah 2 verse 3. His feet have trodden the busy streets of Jerusalem and the shady recesses of the Mount of Olives. His figure has filled with glory the temple and its services. His person has given meaning to the land and the people, and the decease which he accomplished at Jerusalem has been for the life of all nations. These facts can never be passed. They are eternally present, not only to our faith, but also to our hope. For he shall come in like manner as the men of Galilee had on Mount Olivet seen him go into heaven. Ancient memories. But our memories of Jerusalem stretch far back beyond these scenes. In the distance of a remote antiquity, we read of Melchizedek, the typical priest king of Salem, who went out to meet Abraham, the ancestor of the Hebrew race, and blessed him. A little later, and this same Abraham was coming up from Hebron on his mournful journey to offer up his only son. A few miles south of the city, the road by which he traveled climbs the top of a high promontory that juts into the deep Kidron Valley. From this spot, through the cleft of the mountains which the Kedron has made for its course, one object rose up straight before him. It was Moriah, the mount on which the sacrifice of Isaac was to be offered. Here Solomon afterwards built the temple, for over Mount Moriah David had seen the hand of the destroying angel stayed, probably just above where afterwards, from the large altar of burnt offering, the smoke of countless sacrifices rose day by day. On the opposite hill of Zion, separated only by a ravine from Moriah, stood the city and the palace of David, and close by the site of the temple, the Tower of David. After that period, an ever-shifting historical panorama passes before our view, unchanged only in this, that amidst all the varying events, Jerusalem remains the one center of interest and attractions, till we come to that presence which has made it, even in its desolateness, Hephzibah, sought out, a city not forsaken. Isaiah 62:4. Origin of the name. The rabbis have a curious conceit about the origin of the name Jerusalem, which is commonly taken to mean the foundation, the abode, or the inheritance of peace. They make it a compound of Jireh, and Shalem, and say that Abraham called it Jehovah-Jireh, while Shem had it named Shalem, but that God combined the two into Jireh-Shalem, Jeru-Shalem, or Jerusalem. There was certainly something peculiar in the choice of Palestine to be the country of the chosen people, as well as of Jerusalem to be its capital. The political importance of the land must be judged from its situation rather than its size. Lying midway between the east and the west, and placed between the great military monarchies, first of Egypt and Assyria, and then of Rome and the east, it naturally became the battlefield of the nations and the highway of the world. As for Jerusalem, its situation was entirely unique. Pitched on a height of about 2,610 feet above the level of the sea, its climate was more healthy, equable, and temperate than that of any other part of the country. From the top of Mount Olivet, an unrivaled view of the most interesting localities in the land might be obtained. To the east, the eye would wander over the intervening plains to Jericho, mark the tortuous windings of Jordan, and the sullen gray of the Dead Sea, finally resting on Pisgah and the mountains of Moab and Ammon. To the south, you might see beyond the king's gardens, as far as the gray tops of the hill country of Judea. Westwards, the view would be arrested by the mountains of Bether, whilst the haze in the distant horizon marked the line of the great sea. To the north, such well-known localities met the eye as Mizpeh, Gibeon, Ajalon, Michmash, Ramah, and Anathoth. But above all, just at your feet, the holy city would lie in all her magnificence, like a bride adorned for her husband. The situation of Jerusalem. Beautiful for situation, the joy of the whole earth, is Mount Zion, on the sides of the north, the city of the great king. Walk about Zion, and go round about her. Tell the towers thereof, mark ye well her bulwarks. Consider her palaces. If this could be said of Jerusalem even in the humbler days of her native monarchy, Psalm 48, it was emphatically true at the time when Jesus beheld the city, after Herod the Great had adorned it with his wonted splendor. As the pilgrim bands came up from all parts of the country to the great feasts, they must have stood enthralled when its beauty first burst upon their gaze. Not merely remembrances of the past, or the sacred associations connected with the present, but the grandeur of the scene before them must have kindled their admiration into enthusiasm. For Jerusalem was a city of palaces, and right royally enthroned as none other. Placed on an eminence higher than the immediate neighborhood, it was cut off and isolated by deep valleys on all sides but one, giving it the appearance of an immense natural fortress. All round it, on three sides, like a natural fosse, ran the deep ravines of the Valley of Hinnom and of the Black Valley, or Kedron, which merged to the south of the city, descending in such steep declivity that where the two meet is 670 feet below the point whence each had started. Only on the northwest was the city, as it were, bound to the mainland. And as if to give it yet more the character of a series of fortress islands, a deep natural cleft, the Tyropoan, ran south and north right through the middle of the city, then turned sharply westwards, separating Mount Zion from Mount Acra. Similarly, Acra was divided from Mount Moriah, and the latter again by an artificial valley from Bezetha, or the new town. Sheer up from these encircling ravines rose the city of marble and cedar-covered palaces. Up that middle cleft, down in the valley, and along the slopes of the hills, crept the busy town, with its streets, markets, and bazaars. but alone and isolated in its grandeur stood the Temple Mount. Terrace upon terrace its courts rose, till, high above the city, within the enclosure of marble cloisters, cedar-roofed and richly ornamented, the temple itself stood out a mass of snowy marble and of gold, glittering in the sunlight against the half-encircling green background of Olivet. In all his wanderings, the Jew had not seen a city like his own Jerusalem. Not Antioch in Asia, not even Imperial Rome herself, excelled in its architectural splendor. Nor has there been, either in ancient or modern times, a sacred building equal to the temple, whether for situation or magnificence, nor yet have there been festive throngs like those joyous hundreds of thousands who, with their hymns of praise, crowded towards the city on the eve of a Passover. No wonder that the song burst from the lips of those pilgrims, "Still stand our feet within thy gates, Jerusalem. Jerusalem, ah, thou art built as a city joined companion-like together." Psalm 122, verses 2 and 3. From whatever side the pilgrim might approach the city, the first impression must have been solemn and deep. But a special purpose awaited those who came, whether from Jericho or from Galilee, by the well-known road that led over the Mount of Olives. From the south, beyond royal Bethlehem, from the west, descending over the heights of Beth Horon, or from the north, journeying along the mountains of Ephraim, they would have seen the city first vaguely looming in the great distance, till, gradually approaching, they had become familiar with its outlines. It was far otherwise from the east. A turn in the road, and the city, hitherto entirely hid from view, would burst upon them suddenly, closely, and to most marked advantage. It was by this road Jesus made his triumphal entry from Bethany on the week of his Passion. Up from the House of Dates, the broad, rough road would round the shoulder of Olivet. Thither the wandering crowd from Bethany followed him, and there the praising multitude from the city met him. They had come up from that same Olivet, so familiar to them all, for did it not seem almost to form part of the city itself, shutting it off like a screen from the desert land that descended beyond to Jordan and the Dead Sea? Mount of Olives. From the Temple Mount to the western base of Olivet, it was not more than 100 or 200 yards straight across, though, of course, the distance to the summit was much greater, say, about half a mile. By the nearest pathway, it was only 918 yards from the city gate to the principal summit. Olivet was always fresh and green, even in earliest spring or during parched summer, the coolest, the pleasantest, the most sheltered walk about Jerusalem. For across this road the temple and its mountain flung their broad shadows, and the luxuriant foliage spread a leafy canopy overhead. They were not gardens in the ordinary Western sense, through which one passed, far less orchards, but something peculiar to those climes, where nature everywhere strews with lavish hand her flowers and makes her gardens, where the garden bursts into the orchard and the orchard stretches into the sea, till high up olive and fig mingle with the darker cypress and pine. The stony road up Olivet wound around terraces covered with olives, whose silver and dark green leaves rustled in the breeze. Here, gigantic gnarled fig trees twisted themselves out of rocky soil. There, clusters of palms raised their knotty stems high up into wavering plume tufts, or spread bush-like from the ground, the rich-colored fruit bursting in clusters from the pod. Then there were groves of myrtle, pines, tall, stately cypresses, and on the summit itself, two gigantic cedars. To these shady retreats the inhabitants would often come from Jerusalem to take pleasure or to meditate, and there one of the most celebrated rabbis was at one time wont in preference to teach. Thither also Christ with his disciples often resorted. Coming from Bethany, the city would for some time be completely hidden from view by the intervening ridge of Olivet, but a sudden turn of the road, where the descent of the Mount of Olives begins, all at once a first glimpse of Jerusalem is caught, and that quite close at hand. True, the configuration of Olivet on the right would still hide the temple and most part of the city, but across Ophel, the busy suburb of the priests, the eye might range to Mount Zion and rapidly climb its height to where Herod's palace covered the site once occupied by that of David. A few intervening steps of descent, where the view of the city has again been lost, and the pilgrim would hurry on to that ledge of rock. What a panorama over which to roam with hungry eagerness! At one glance he would see before him the whole city, its valleys and hills, its walls and towers, its palaces and streets, and its magnificent temple, almost like a vision from another world. There could be no difficulty in making out the general features of the scene. Altogether, the city was only 33 stadia, or about 4 English miles, in circumference. Within this compass dwelt a population of 600,000, according to Tacitus, but, according to the Jewish historian, amounting at the time of the Passover to between 2 and 3 millions, or about equal to that of London. The walls. The first feature to attract attention would be the city walls. At the time of Christ, only 2 in number. The first, or Old Wall, began at the northwestern angle of Zion, at the Tower of Hippicus, and ran along the northern brow of Zion, where it crossed the cleft and joined the western colonnade of the temple at the council house. It also enclosed Zion along the west and the south, and was continued eastward around Ophel, till it merged in the southeastern angle of the temple. Thus the first wall would defend Zion, Ophel, and, along with the temple walls, Moriah also. The second wall, which commenced at a gate in the first wall, called Genoth, ran first north and then east so as to enclose Acre, and terminated at the Tower of Antonia. Thus, the whole of the old city and the temple were sufficiently protected. Tower of Antonia. The Tower of Antonia was placed at the northwestern angle of the temple, midway between the castle of the same name and the temple. With the former, it communicated by a double set of cloisters, with the latter by a subterranean passage into the temple itself, and also by cloisters, and stairs descending into the northern and the western porches of the court of the Gentiles. Some of the most glorious traditions in Jewish history were connected with this castle, for there had been the ancient armory of David, the palace of Hezekiah and of Nehemiah, and the fortress of the Maccabees. But in the days of Christ, Antonia was occupied by a hated Roman garrison which kept watch over Israel, even in its sanctuary. In fact, the Tower of Antonia overlooked and commanded the temple, so that a detachment of soldiers could, at any time, rush down to quell a riot, as on the occasion when the Jews had almost killed Paul, Acts 21:31. The city walls were further defended by towers, 60 in the first and 40 in the second wall. Most prominent among them was Hippicus, Phasaelus, and Mariamim, close by each other, to the northwest of Zion, all compactly built of immense marble blocks, square, strongly fortified, and surmounted by buildings defended by battlements and turrets. They were built by Herod, and named after the friend and the brother he had lost in battle, and the wife whom he jealously had killed. The four hills. If the pilgrim scanned the city more closely, he would observe that it was built on four hills. Of these, the western or ancient Zion was the highest, rising about 200 feet above Moriah, though still 100 feet lower than the Mount of Olives. To the north and the east, opposite Zion, and divided from it by the deep Tyropean Valley, were the crescent-shaped Acra and Moriah, the latter with Ophel as its southern outrunner. Up and down the slopes of Acra, the lower city crept. Finally, the fourth hill, Bezetha, the new town, rose north of the Temple Mount and of Acra, and was separated from them by an artificial valley. The streets, which, as in all eastern cities, were narrow, were paved with white marble. A somewhat elevated footway ran along for the use of those who had newly been purified in the temple, while the rest walked in the roadway below. The streets derived their names mostly from the gates to which they led or from the various bazaars. Thus there were Water Street, Fish Street, East Street, etc. The Timber Bazaar and that of the tailors were in the new city, the grand upper market on Mount Zion. Then there were the Wool and the Braziers Bazaar, Baker Street, Butcher Street, Strangler's Street, and many others similarly named. Nor would it have been difficult to identify the most prominent buildings in the city. At the northwestern angle of Mount Zion, the ancient Salem and Jebus, on the site of the Castle of David, was the grand palace of Herod, generally occupied by the Roman procurators during their temporary sojourn in Jerusalem. It stood high up, just within shelter of the great towers which Herod had reared, a marvel of splendor, of whose extent, strength, height, rooms, towers, roofs, porticos, courts, and adjacent gardens, Josephus speaks in such terms of admiration. High Priest's Palace. At the opposite or northeastern corner of Mount Zion was the palace of the high priest. Being built on the slope of the hill, there was, under the principal apartments, a lower story, with a porch in front, so that we can understand how, on that eventful night, Peter was beneath in the palace, Mark 14:66. Beyond it, probably on the slope of Acra, was the repository of the archives, and on the other side of the cleft, abutting on the temple, with which it was probably connected by a colonnade, the council chamber of the Sanhedrin. Following the eastward brow of Mount Zion, south of the high priest's palace, and opposite the temple, was the immense exodus, which probably extended into the Tyropoean. Whatever may have been its original purpose, it was afterwards used as a place of public meetings, where, on great occasion, the populace was harangued. Here, Peter probably addressed the 3,000 converts on the day of Pentecost, when the multitude had hurried thither from the temple on hearing the mighty rushing sound. The exodus was surrounded by a covered colonnade. Behind it was the palace of Agrippa, the ancient palace of David, and of the Maccabees, and again, in the rear of it, that of Bernice. On Acra stood afterwards the palaces of certain foreign princes, such as those of Queen Helena, King Monobasis, and other proselytes. In this quarter, or even beyond it, to the northwest, one would naturally look for the theater and the amphitheater, which, being so essentially un-Jewish, must have been located as far as possible from the temple. The space around the temple was no doubt kept clear of buildings. On the southeastern corner behind it was the great sheep market, and to the south of the hippodrome. Originally, the king's house by the horse gate, built by Solomon, and the royal stables had occupied the southern area of the Temple Mount, where Herod afterwards built the royal porch. For the Temple of Solomon was 300 feet shorter from north to south than that of Herod. Transversely, between Ixtus and the Fish Gate, lay the quarter of Moktesh, Zephaniah 1:10 and 11, occupied by various bazaars, chiefly connected with the temple. Lastly, south of the temple, but on the same hill, was Ophel, the crowded suburb of the priests. The Shushan Gate. Such must have been a first view of Jerusalem, as beheld from the Mount of Olives, on which we are supposed to have taken our stand. If Jewish tradition on the subject may be trusted, a gate opened upon this Mount of Olives through the eastern wall of the temple. It is called the Shushan Gate, from the sculptured representation over it of the city to which so many Jewish memories attached. From this gate, an arched roadway, by which the priests brought out the red heifer, and on the Day of Atonement the scapegoat, is said to have conducted to the Mount of Olives. Near the spot where the red heifer was burned were extensive lavatories and booths for the sale of articles needed for various purifications. Up a crest, on one of the most commanding elevations, was the lunar station, whence, by fire signals, the advent of each new moon was telegraphed from hill to hill into faraway countries. If Jewish tradition may further be trusted, there was also an unused gate in the city towards the north, and two gates toward the south. We know for certain of only a subterranean passage which led from the Fortress Antonia on the northwestern angle of the temple into the temple court, and of the cloisters with stairs descending into the porches, by one of which the chief captain Lysias rushed to the rescue of Paul, when nearly killed by the infuriated multitude. Dismissing all doubtful questions, we are sure that at any rate five gates opened into the outer temple enclosure, or court of the Gentiles, one from the south and four, and these the principal, from the west. That southern gate was double and must have chiefly served the convenience of the priests. Coming from Ophel, they would pass through its gigantic archway and vestibule, 40 feet each way, and then by a double tunnel nearly 200 feet long, whence they emerged at a flight of steps leading straight up from the court of the Gentiles into that of the priests, close to the spot where they would officiate. But to the great crowd of worshippers we have to enter the city itself. Turning our back on Mount Zion, we now faced eastwards to Mount Moriah. Though we look towards the four principal entrances to the temple, yet what we see within those walls on the highest of the terraces is not the front, but the back of the sanctuary. It is curious how tradition is here in the most palpable error in turning to the east to worship. The holy place itself faced eastwards and was approached from the east, but most assuredly the ministering priests and the worshippers looked not towards the east, but towards the west. The Temple Plateau. The Temple Plateau had been artificially leveled at immense labor and cost, and enlarged by gigantic substructures. The latter served also partly for the purpose of purification, as otherwise there might have been some dead body beneath, which, however great the distance from the surface, would, unless air had intervened, have, according to tradition, defiled the whole place above. As enlarged by Herod the Great, the temple area occupied an elongated square of from 925 to 950 feet and upwards. Roughly calculating it at about 1,000 feet, this would give an extent more than one half greater than that of St. Peter's at Rome, which measures 613 feet and nearly double our own St. Paul's, whose extreme length is 520 1/2 feet. And then we must bear in mind that the temple plateau was not merely about 1,000 feet in length, but a square of nearly 1,000 feet. It was not, however, in the center of this square, but towards the northwest, that the temple itself and its special courts were placed. Nor, as already hinted, were they all on a level, but rose terrace upon terrace, till the sacred edifice itself was reached, its porch protruding shoulder-like on either side, perhaps rising into two flanking towers, and covering the holy and most holy places. Thus must the golden fane have been clearly visible from all parts, the smoke of its sacrifices slowly curling up against the blue eastern sky, and the music of its services wafted across the busy city, while the sunlight glittered on its gilt roofs, or shone from its pavement of tessellated marble, or threw great shadows on Olivet behind. Fables of the Rabbis. Assuredly, when the rabbis thought of their city in her glory, they might well say, "The world is like unto an eye. The ocean surrounding the world is the white of the eye. Its black is the world itself. The pupil is Jerusalem, but the image within the pupil is the sanctuary." In their sorrow and loneliness, they must have written many fabled things of Jerusalem, of which some may here find a place to show with what halo of reverence they surrounded the loving memories of the past. Jerusalem, they say, belonged to no tribe in particular. It was all Israel's. And this is in great measure literally true, for even afterwards, when ancient Jebus became the capital of the land, the boundary line between Judah and Benjamin ran right through the middle of the city and of the temple, so that, according to Jewish tradition, the porch and the sanctuary itself were in Benjamin, and the temple courts and altar in Judah. In Jerusalem, no house might be hired. The houses belonged, as it were, to all, for they must all be thrown open in free-hearted hospitality to the pilgrim brethren who came up to the feast. Never had anyone failed to find in Jerusalem the means of celebrating the Paschal festivities, nor yet had any lacked a bed on which to rest. Never did serpent or scorpion hurt within her precincts, never did fire desolate her streets, nor ruin occur. No ban ever rested on the holy city. It was Levitically more sacred than other cities, since there alone the Paschal lamb, the thank offerings, and the second tithes might be eaten. Hence, they carefully guarded against all possibility of pollution. No dead body might remain in the city overnight. No sepulchres were there, except those of the house of David and of the prophetess Huldah. Not even domestic fowls might be kept, nor vegetable gardens be planted, lest the smell of decaying vegetation should defile the air, nor yet furnaces be built for fear of smoke. Never had adverse accident interrupted the services of the sanctuary, nor profaned the offerings. Never had rain extinguished the fire on the altar, nor contrary wind driven back the smoke of the sacrifices. Nor yet, however great the crowd of worshippers, had any failed for room to bow down and worship the God of Israel. Thus far the rabbis. All the more impressive is their own admission and their lament, so significant as viewed in the light of the gospel. For 3 years and a half abode the Shekinah, or visible divine presence, on the Mount of Olives, waiting whether Israel would repent, and calling upon them, "Seek ye the Lord while he may be found, call upon him while he is near." And when all was in vain, then the Shekinah returned to its own place. Jerusalem in ruins. The Shekinah has withdrawn to its own place. Both the city and the temple have been laid even with the ground, because Jerusalem knew not the time of her visitation. Luke 19:44. They had laid Jerusalem on heaps. Psalm 79:1. The stones of the sanctuary are poured out in the top of every street. Lamentations 4:1. All this, and much more, did the Savior, the rightful King of Israel, see in the near future when he beheld the city and wept over it. And now we must search very deep down, sinking the shaft from 60 to over 125 feet through the rubbish of accumulated ruins before reaching at last the ancient foundations. And there, close by where once the royal bridge spanned the deep chasm and led from the city of David into the royal porch of the temple, is the Jews' wailing place, where the mourning heirs to all this desolation reverently embrace the fallen stones and weep unavailing tears, unavailing because the present is as the past, and because what brought that judgment and sorrow is unrecognized, unrepented, unremoved. Yet, watchman, what of the night? Watchman, what of the night? The watchman said, "The morning cometh, and also the night. If ye will inquire, inquire. Return, come."